The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with Mark Amtower of Amtower & Company, which is entirely responsible for its content.
This is Amtower Off-Center, sponsored by General Dynamics Information Technology. Every week, author, speaker, consultant Mark Amtower gives you his take on what's going on in the world of government contracting. Amtower Off-Center, with your host, Mark Amtower.
Welcome to Amtower Off Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. A little teaser before I introduce my guest. If you saw a recent article of mine, Marketing Lessons from Military History and Washington Technology, you may know who my guest is. But that was prompted by an article I saw in Marketing Profs, which was prompted me to reach out to this gentleman. I was listening to a book called Masters of Command in my car. Howard County Library is extraordinary. All of this guy's books are there, as well as some on audio. So I'm listening to this book, come home to the office, and lo and behold, there's an article in Marketing Profs, Disruptive Marketing Lessons from the Trojan Horse by Dr. Barry Strauss, the chairman of the History Department of Cornell University. Barry, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mark. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a thrill to have you. I don't often do a lot of lead time with guests, but because you didn't happen to be in the country at the time, we had to. And I'll thank Amanda for this from your PR agency for helping me cue this up. So thank you, Amanda. But
yes, indeed. Thanks, Amanda.
Yeah, be that as it may, you've got at least five books of your own out on military history, one on rowing, of all things, which comes into play with one of the books anyway. Give me a little background here. I can understand being a history professor, because that's probably where all your degrees are. But what got you into the military history side of things?
Oh, I've always been interested in military history. I think, you know, ever since hearing my dad's stories about World War II when I was growing up, when he fought in the Italian campaign. I was fortunate to study with some really terrific people, particularly Donald Kagan at Yale, who is a great military historian and really inspired my interest in the subject. So it's been something that's, I've been interested in my whole career.
Okay. Well, and then the twist comes, Marketing Lessons from the Trojan Horse. Mm-hmm. What prompted you to start thinking about business marketing when you're reading about military history?
I think in part, again, my dad was a businessman, and family thinks my dad was a businessman, my wife's a businesswoman, and I think in part my experience as a department chair. I've now stepped down as department chair, but I was department chair for 6 years, and academia is not a business like other businesses, but you do have to ask some basic questions about how businesses work, and you realize that there are a lot of analogies, there's a lot of cross-fertilization between military history and business.
Okay, that makes sense. You know, for me, I look at situations, and this showed up in the article I wrote, I look at situations in the marketing realm and liken some of them to marketing or military campaigns. First book out on that I know of was Jack Trout and Al Reese, 30 plus years ago, Marketing Warfare. But the article, let's start with the article you did for Marketing Profs. Did you reach out to them, or did they reach out to you, or how did you hook up with them?
My publicist arranged that, so he made that happen. But I think it was kind of a natural.
It is a natural, and I was happy to see it there. And I'm hoping that you do some more of it. And, you know, if not with them, maybe a book. But there you go. But let's you made 5 points in that. First of all, bet on the right horse. Obviously, everybody knows the Trojan Horse story. But what do you mean by bet on the right horse?
Well, you know, when the Greeks chose the Trojan horse they didn't choose a horse by at random. They knew that the horse was a very significant and beloved symbol for the Trojans. The Trojans were horse dealers, and so by giving them a horse, they were playing to their vanity and their pride. So they chose their weapon very carefully. And I think that's a lesson for all of us. You have to give people what they want, which is not necessarily what you want, but you have to know your audience and what they're looking for.
Okay. Second point was erode your enemy's confidence or your competitor's confidence.
Yes. So the Greeks had done some research, and they knew that the Trojans were really suffering from the length of the war. In myth, the war lasted 10 years. In reality, it was probably more like a year or two. The Greeks were unable to take the city of Troy by assault because it had very strong defenses. Nonetheless, the strain of holding up in Troy for this period was really hurting the people of Troy. So the Greeks knew that the Trojans were weak psychologically and morally, and that's what they played on with the horse.
Okay. Getting your team to think different. Odysseus played a role here as well.
Yeah, now this was a really tough one for the Greeks. The Greeks, the Greek way of war was a very macho, traditional, rock 'em, sock 'em, fight a battle thing so that you can win glory on the battlefield, kill your enemy, bring home trophies. That's what it was all about. What Odysseus had to convince the Greeks to do is to say, no, we're not going to do that. We just can't win that way. The only way we can win is by using a trick, doing something that's risky, but not our traditional way of war. And I think in all activities, it's very difficult to get people out of their comfort zone. People like to do what they're good at and what they're used to doing. To get people to fight or play or market in a different way is tremendously difficult. So I think that was, in a way, the hardest task facing the Greeks, was to get one of their leaders, Odysseus, to come up with a plan and then sell to his team to implement this plan and to behave in a completely different way from what they were used to.
Okay. Yeah, and that's going to come into play with the horse itself, because, you know, the one-on-one battle in the battlefield is not hiding in a horse and sneaking out in the middle of the night.
Yeah, no. The Greeks thought that this was bad, this was cowardly, this was unmanly. It's precisely what they didn't want to do. And yet, that's in the end what they did, and it proved to be successful. So it really spoke to Odysseus' powers of persuasion that he was able to get them to do this in the first place.
Yeah, and that comes into play a lot in the age of chivalry and in a lot of the ancient battles where, you know, if you shoot your arrow, you have to give your enemy a chance to shoot his before you can shoot again.
Right. Well, you know, people like the idea of a fair fight, but in fact, successful warfare is usually unfair, and that's something people have to accept.
Well, you know, successful marketing hopefully is tilting the field in your favor as well. So there's no such thing as a level playing field, particularly if you're there first.
No. And, you know, I think we are misled sometimes by the analogy, the sports analogy, where we think it's all going to be equal and fair, but it's not. And even in sports, it's not.
Okay. Point four, recruit the best people and provide leadership.
Yes. So to make the horse work, Odysseus couldn't get just anyone. He had to get, first of all, he had to get a craftsman. And according to the myth, there was a man named Epeius. He's the man who built the horse. Again, it's not the sort of thing that the Greeks are typically thinking about in warfare, but it's the kind of person who had come to the fore for Odysseus to carry out this task. So often in warfare, and I think in business, you're successful by turning to people other than the usual suspects and other than the people who you would think of turning to.
Bingo. And the last point in the Marketing Profs article, and I'll put the link to this on the Federal News Radio website, so you don't need to look for it. Don't be tempted to abandon the plan, even if you meet resistance.
Right. So, you know, when the Greeks left the horse before Troy, they ran into a problem, and the problem was Helen. Helen of Troy, we call her, but Helen was Greek. She'd run off to Troy with her Trojan lover, Prince Paris. And very clever lady, she figured out what the horse was all about. And so she walked around the horse and called to the men in it, imitating their wives' voices, trying to get them to break down. So it required a lot of discipline and self-control for the Greeks not to fall for this trick, because Helen was very good at what she did. So they had to show patience and resilience, and that too was part of the plan and part of the challenge of making this work.
There you go. we're going to take our first break. You can find Dr. Strauss and his books at Barry Strauss, BarryStrauss.com. I suggest you do so. I've read five of his books. It was almost like studying, you know, in graduate school, again, getting ready for this this interview, and it was a blast. But find him at BarryStrauss.com. You are listening to AmTower Off Center on FederalNewsRadio.com and 1500 AM, and we will be right back. Welcome back to AmTower Off Center on FederalNewsRadio.com and 1500 AM. I'm here with Professor Barry Strauss of Cornell University. You can find him again, BarryStrauss.com. I suggest you do so. These books are great. These aren't, you know, like your tomes of history. These are fun reads. So Masters of Command, The Trojan War, The Battle of Salamis, The Spartacus Wars, and the death of Caesar. Odd coincidence. I was reading the Gallic Wars, Caesar's own account of that, when I ran across Masters of Command, which led me to the death of Caesar, which I then read right after the Gallic War. So, and the death of Caesar is a much easier read than the Gallic War. So, and I know you've read that. So,
I have, yeah.
Yeah. So let's start with the Trojan War. And one of the first things you mention in the book, and this comes into play too, especially, you know, what you said about, you know, heroic one-on-one fighting in the last segment, the power of patience comes into play here.
Right.
How important is that for the Greeks here and in some of the other battles that you discuss?
Oh, patience! We can't overestimate how important it is. It's absolutely key component, especially for us living nowadays in a world in which we want everything right away. We want instant explanations. We don't tend to look at the long term, but in fact, you've got to look at the long term. You've got to take things in perspective, and it also means that you have to be patient about getting results. The Greeks, they too, in a way, wanted an instant result. They wanted the satisfaction of a battle that was basically a brawl. And, you know, they wanted to come out swinging and hit their enemy. But that, in fact, was not the way for them to take Troy. And the only way to do it was to fight a longer game and wear the Trojans out to the point where the Trojans would fall victim to the Greeks' trick. Very difficult lesson to get warriors to accept.
Yeah, and we've discussed this offline before. Arthur Wellesley, the Duke of Wellington, never lost a battle. He fought in the Netherlands. He fought in India, and obviously during the Napoleonic Wars through Europe, through Portugal, mm-hmm. through Spain into France and Waterloo, but there's a key component to him never having lost. Would you explain that, please?
Yeah, he chose his battles very carefully, and he made people wait until the right moment and the right battlefield. So that's absolutely essential.
Okay, We discussed this before, and I made a quantum leap that was wrong. How important was the Trojan War in retrospect to the Greeks' ability to either not get together as a collection of people, but as independent states, or not? I mean, I thought more of them had gathered against the Persians, and that's just not the case.
No. I mean, we're used to the idea of the famous wars between the Greeks and Persians, with the Greeks on one side and the Persians on the other. But in reality, most of the Greek city-states either stayed neutral or they supported the Persians. Only a minority of Greek city-states fought against the Persians. It's a sign, first of all, that the ancient Greek world was very much divided, very much parochial and particularistic. And secondly, that the Persians were pretty good diplomats and chose their targets carefully. And they were able to offer incentives to some of the Greeks to support them. Third, the Persians had already conquered part of the Greek world, and most of those Greeks who were fighting under the Persians had made their peace with the Persians, and they were willing to fight for the Persians. Only a minority of the Greeks under Persian rule helped the Greeks who were resisting them. So it's even more of a feat that the Athenians and the Spartans and the other Greeks who resisted Persia were able to win, because the Greek world was typically divided and not united.
Well, the Athenians and the Spartans in particular were very loyal to their cities, and it seems right to me that Xerxes and perhaps Darius as well, they used a huge number of mercenaries whose loyalty may not have been quite the same.
Yes, I mean, one of the advantages that the Greeks had, the Athenians and the Spartans had, was that they were fighting for themselves, and they came from small republics with intense citizen bonds and loyalty. They were also defending their own country, whereas Persia was an empire. It was vast. It was the largest empire the world had seen to that date. It had the advantages of empire, and that had big, big resources and a multitude of peoples, but the disadvantage that people were not as tied to the empire winning or losing as the other side was. So each side has its advantages and disadvantages, and you have to know how to make the most of what you've got.
And, that comes into play in the government market, because there's a lot of teaming that goes on, temporary alliances between contractors, especially when companies are going after a large contract, and in our market that could be, tens of billions of dollars worth of business. But one of the constant complaints I hear from small businesses especially is they get on a team, then they don't get any business. So you've really got to be careful when you choose your alliances here.
You absolutely do. You absolutely have to, choose a situation that's going to allow you to shine and to bring out your best.
Let's migrate to probably the shortest term of the emperors of Rome, Julius Caesar.
Right.
One of my favorite phrases is crossing the Rubicon. And
right.
It's part of the vernacular now.
Yes.
But a lot of people really don't understand what it came from and why it was important, particularly to Julius Caesar. Can you spend a couple of minutes on that?
Oh, yeah. I could spend more than a couple of minutes. The Rubicon was a stream in northern Italy, located today sort of set between Ravenna and Rimini, so south of Venice. Mm-hmm. And it marked the boundary in the first century BC. It marked the boundary between Italy proper and Gaul. We're used to thinking of Gaul as being equivalent to France, but for the Romans, Gaul was the area of where the Celtic peoples lived who they had conquered, and it starts in northern Italy, because northern Italy was inhabited in Roman times originally by Celts, not not by Latin speakers, the other people of Italy. So south of the Rubicon, you were in Italy proper. North of the Rubicon, you were in the province of Gaul. Romans called it Cisalpine Gaul or Italian Gaul, Gaul south of the Alps. Caesar was the governor of Gaul, whether south of the Alps or north of the Alps, and he legally had the right to maintain an army there, command an army there. He did not have the right to bring his army into Italy proper. Once you got to Italy proper, you had to disband the army, because that was civil territory, not foreign territory. So by crossing the Rubicon, Caesar is violating the law. He is invading Italy with his army. He's engaging in an act of illegality and, in fact, starting a civil war. So when Caesar crossed the Rubicon, he was announcing, I'm at war with the Roman government. The Roman government had told him to disband his army. He refused. Instead, he said the Roman government has been taken over by a faction that wants to oppress the Roman people. They've taken my rightful authority away from me, and I have no choice but to march on Rome and to restore the rule of the Roman people. So it really marked the start of the Civil War and a point of no return.
Okay, the point of no return's the intriguing part for me.
Yes.
And the war was, 3 years?
No, it was 5 years.
5 years. But...
Or 4 years, excuse me, 4 years.
Somewhere around there.
Yeah.
Not particularly short, but not ridiculously long. I guess if you were part of it, it was ridiculously long. But, yeah. When Caesar finally won... obviously, there were still major disgruntled factions in Rome.
Yes.
Why did he go without his bodyguard?
That's a great question. I think he went without his bodyguard for a couple of reasons. First of all, Caesar didn't like the idea that he was so unpopular in Rome that he needed a bodyguard to survive. He was enough of an old-fashioned Roman that he thought that, when a Roman's in Rome, he should be accessible to the Roman people, the Roman senators in Rome. Secondly, he felt that he had covered himself by killing a lot of his enemies and by pardoning the rest. And third, we should never forget that Caesar was a soldier, a very heroic soldier who had won the second highest decoration known to a Roman at the age of 20. He thought of himself as a war hero, and he did not like the idea of cowardice, walking around with a bodyguard in Rome. So he really thought that he could get away with this, not having a bodyguard. He was also a man who just loved risk. He loved pushing the envelope, pushing things to the limit, and that was another reason why he went without a bodyguard in Rome.
Well, I saw that in the Gallic Wars, too, because right. He had a lot of outposts that, in the fall or winter were kind of isolated, and when they were attacked, he would, from the front, lead the rescue.
Yeah, that's correct. He was a risk taker. In Gaul, he really kept pushing himself and pushing himself. And, getting back to the Rubicon, when he crossed the Rubicon, he's supposed to have said, let the dice fly high. In other words, I know I'm tossing the dice. I know this is a risk. I love it. And that's the kind of person he was.
Okay. in intriguing and a very short reign, by the way. You're listening to AmTower Off Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'll be back with Dr. Strauss right after this. Welcome back to AmTower Off Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm here with Dr. Barry Strauss, professor of history at Cornell University, author of a number of fascinating books. I suggest you find the books. Easiest way to do that is barrystrauss.com. Dr. Strauss, Barry also does speaking. So if you're interested in having a historical perspective in your next event, I would strongly suggest taking a serious look at Dr. Strauss's website. There's a lot of stuff there. The blog's got a really a lot of good things, a lot of topics to choose from, a lot of lessons from history for business here. So BarryStrauss.com. Let's talk about my favorite movie of all times. Well, we'll talk about the book and the guy, but my favorite movie of all times is Spartacus.
Great choice.
Kirk Douglas. The Spartacus Wars wasn't the first slave rebellion.
No, it wasn't.
So,
there had been two other great rebellions in Sicily that the Romans had faced, and they'd had some small slave rebellions in Italy before. So Spartacus is in a tradition of slave rebellions.
But he's the first name brand.
He's the first name brand. That's right. He's the first name brand. It's partly because the Romans never forgot him. You know, Latin literature over the centuries, down to St. Augustine, is full of Spartacus, whereas they didn't really remember the names of the other rebel leaders. And in fact, I'm embarrassed to say I don't quite remember their names myself, although I've written about them.
Dude 1 and Dude 2.
Dude 1 and Dude 2. Part of the problem was that Sicily, we tend to think that Sicily's part of Italy because it's part of the modern state of Italy, but for the Romans, Sicily was a province. It wasn't Italy. It was them, not us. And most of the inhabitants of Sicily were Greek speakers or Punic speakers, not Latin speakers, so it was a bit foreign, whereas the Spartacus revolt takes place in Italy. You know, it starts out in Capua, which is very close to Rome. Some of it's fought along the Appian Way, and Spartacus threatens Rome at various points. He goes up and down the Italian peninsula, so it's very close to home. That's one thing. Another thing is Spartacus is a gladiator, and gladiator is in some ways the ultimate Roman hero, the ultimate Roman sports hero. So Spartacus is not them, he's us. And Spartacus, before he became a gladiator, he had been an allied soldier serving in the Roman army. So he's an insider in many different ways, and threatened the Romans in a way that the slave revolts in far-off Sicily didn't.
Well, there's a particular lesson I want to get to with the first legion that was sent out under Gaius Claudius, and I forget his last name.
It was Glaber.
That's it, Glaber.
Yeah. But
one of the reasons for the success of the Roman legions was every time they camped, there was a routine that they went through that was important. Explain that, please.
Well, you know, the Romans built their camps with military precisions. They were laid out as rectangles. There were streets at right angles. They had ditches and dikes around the camp. They would build them up, and they would always be very carefully guarded. And these were just the camps they'd be in for a night and then move on to someplace else. So they're very precise and organized about it. And it's one of the reasons for their success. But they sometimes let their discipline down, especially if they thought the enemy was unworthy. And with Spartacus was one of those cases. The Romans believed their own propaganda about how slaves and barbarians were unworthy. You couldn't win a triumph, for example. A Roman general who defeated slaves was not allowed to celebrate a triumph because he didn't deserve a triumph for merely defeating slaves. They weren't important enough. And so when Glaber came out and trapped Spartacus and his men on Mount Vesuvius, and there was really only one road up and down the mountain, they thought, we don't need to defend our camp. You know, we don't have to worry about these guys. We've got the road covered. And anyhow, they're just slaves. They're just runaway slaves. What do we have to fear from them? Big mistake.
They climbed down the mountain not using the pass. Virtually no guards except at the road.
Yeah, and you know, to get down the mountain, they wove. There were women with them, and the women did the weaving, I'm sure. They wove makeshift ropes out of wild grapevines. It was really a tremendous feat of guerrilla warfare, kind of a classic feat. And they went down the side of the mountain, and as you say, there were no guards, and they were able to take the camp, it was really pretty easy for them to fall on the camp, undefended, unsuspecting. It was a slaughter.
Yeah. And, you know, ultimately he was defeated by Marcus Crassus, who did not take him lightly and who, like Wellington, chose the battlefield to his advantage. He would not fight in the forest. He would not fight on the hills.
Right.
He would make
right.
Spartacus come down to the plains.
That's correct.
So,
yes.
I learned that from your book.
So. Oh, good.
Well, you know, that's why I read them. And it's probably why I'll read them again in a while.
Well, thanks. I'm thrilled to hear that. Really honored.
You know, it's fun to do a show like this on occasion because, you know, the Romans underestimating Spartan, we've seen that in a number of business settings before. An incumbent contractor thinking they are pretty much inviolate and being upended by an upstart. You know, a company, you know, half the size, a third the size, not even a tenth the size. But they're replaced because somebody's coming up with a new idea, a guerrilla tactic. They're undermining something.
I live in upstate New York, and, you know, look at Kodak, which was once a giant. Now gone because it underestimated. IBM has survived, but also underestimated the competition.
Well, Xerox, you know, the president famously said, you know, who wants a computer in their house? And Palo Alto Research Center, which was owned and I think still owned by Xerox, was the birthplace of the PC.
Yep.
So Mr. Gates and Mr. Jobs took the next step, as it were.
Yep.
Let's talk about a non-Roman guy for a couple of minutes here.
Sure.
A gentleman from Carthage, name of Hannibal.
Yes.
Interesting guy. We talked about beachheads earlier. Talk about how he established, how he leveraged beachhead.
Yeah, well, you know, Hannibal is well known for his famous invasion of Italy by going overland from Spain and crossing the Alps with his men and 37 elephants. But he didn't choose to do that at random. He'd already done his research and sent delegates to northern Italy. This is the area that the Romans called Italian Gaul. Most of the population were Celts. They'd been conquered by the Romans only a generation earlier.
North of the Rubicon.
That's right, yeah, on the other side of the Rubicon. They were restive under Roman rule, and Hannibal was able to ascertain that they would support him. They were ready to revolt against Rome if he came with an army. They would support him. So that was his beachhead. Now, as it happened, the crossing of the Alps, the journey to northern Italy, was so much worse than he had estimated that he came with a tiny army compared to what he said he was going to come with. And when he got there, the Celts took one look at him and said, sorry, we're not taking our chances against the Romans with you. We thought you were going to come here with a serious army, not with this. So what he did... defend his beachhead, he then had to make an example of the nearest Celtic tribe. He crossed the Alps right near the modern city of Torino, and he then turned on them and slaughtered the people there. And the rest of the Celts said, oh, what do you know? Hannibal really is a serious warrior after all. So, yes, we're going to give him his beachhead and fight the Romans. And so it turned out to be quite successful.
Yeah. Does the phrase barbarians at the gate emanate from his proximity to Rome a short time later?
Yes. The Romans talked about Hannibal ad portas, Hannibal at the gates. I mean, this was kind of a rallying cry for the Romans. The Republic's in danger. It was a synonym, really, for the Republic in danger. Hannibal's at the gates.
Cool.
Because he had so threatened Rome. Now, in the end, of course, he doesn't take Rome. He doesn't really even seriously threaten it. But for a time, it looked like he would.
Well, and you know, there's military reasons there. He had he didn't have replacement soldiers coming in. He had to rely on pretty much what he came over with.
Mm-hmm.
And after a couple of battles, you know, he did kick some serious butt. But he was somewhat depleted.
Right. Now, this is one of the great debates of military history, and scholars still debate, why didn't Hannibal attack Rome? And what you're saying is absolutely true. He certainly didn't have the manpower to take Rome by siege, any more than Scipio Africanus later had the manpower to take Carthage by siege, or by much less by assault. Still, Hannibal said after he left Italy, I made a mistake by not marching on Rome after I smashed the Roman army at Cannae. And I think he did make a mistake, because I think he might have won the war psychologically by showing up in at Rome and indicating that the Carthaginians were there. They're in the enemy's territory, and they threatened not so much the walls of Rome, which would have been hard, probably impossible to take, but they threatened the alliance of Rome. And that was really the key to victory for Hannibal, to break Rome's alliance. And the way to do that, I think, was to bring his army to Roman territory. Could have exercised a powerful effect.
Could have changed the course of history.
It could have changed the course of history. We might all be speaking a language with a Punic base to it today rather than a Latin base.
There you go. We're going to take our last break here. You're listening to AmTower Off Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. When we come back, we'll talk about a couple of my other favorite things, Alexander, Thermopylae, Xerxes, and Salamis. Back after this. Welcome back to AmTower Off Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm here with Dr. Barry Strauss, professor of history at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. Is that right?
You're up there? That's right, Ithaca.
Ithaca, New York. I've been there.
Have you?
Yeah.
Not in the winter, I hope, for your
Unfortunately, the first time I was there was in January, and I went outside with not a real thick coat, and my voice changed.
I'm not surprised. I hope you at least got to see a hockey game.
No, I was there to speak, so.
Okay.
But you know, really good Italian food there.
There is, so, as a matter of fact.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about the first major empire builder. Well, I guess not really the first major, but certainly one of the greatest, Alexander. What in his background, besides being the son of Philip, gave him the skills to accomplish what he did?
Well, he, besides being Philip's son genetically, he was trained, educated to be a great soldier and great statesman. One of his teachers was no less a figure than Aristotle, one of the greatest philosophers who ever lived. Alexander, besides being just an excellent warrior, was a superb speaker and leader of men, was a great strategist and a man who had a lot of self-control. You know, he comes to power at a very early age, but he knows enough to leave a lot of power in the hands of an older generation because he needs to learn from them. He knows his limitations. So he's not just very precocious, but he has a precocious maturity, which is one of the things that leads to his success. You see that sometimes in history. Augustus, another one of these people, who is just amazingly mature at the age of 19 when he bursts on the scene. So that's one of the things that's so impressive about Alexander, is not just what he does, but what he can hold back from.
He seems to have known his enemy much better than his enemy knew him, at least initially.
Yes.
How? Why?
Well, he's inheriting a war that his father has started. So the Macedonians have already been thinking about how to fight this war before they go on and fight it. So he's got that sense of it. But also we have to say he was lucky in that the Persians had... they had given some thought as well to how to fight the Greeks and to how to fight the Macedonians. The Persian high command was divided as to how to do that. Historically, they'd been very successful by stirring up a revolt in the Greek. Whenever the Greeks had attacked them, they'd been very successful in using traitors and stirring up a revolt in the Greek rear because the Greeks were always divided. They started out using that strategy against Alexander. There was a Persian general who was himself a Greek, who had gone to fight for the Persians, married a Persian woman, had Persian children. And he was a real threat to Alexander. He threatened to create a revolt in Greece that would have forced Alexander to go home. And with incredible good fortune, he dies very early on in the war. Once he does, there's really no one in the Persian government to champion this strategy against Alexander. It's so fortunate for Alexander that some novelists have speculated that Alexander had him poisoned. But there's no evidence of that whatsoever. It's just a lucky thing. So Alexander, he's got a very good strategy, but he's also a lucky guy that the Persians aren't able to play their best card.
Okay. You know, overextending his supply lines never really played a role considering the size of the area he conquered. But I think, you know, and you know, if I'm wrong, say so. I think the major problem he had was after several years, he had lost touch with the original troops that he had brought with him.
Yes. I mean, Alexander, you know, invades Afghanistan and Afghanistan in what's today Pakistan and India, and he wants to keep going. He would have conquered all of India if it was up to him. But his troops mutiny, and they force him to turn back. That's because he overestimated their willingness to go so far from home and to fight under, you know, very unpleasant conditions of a monsoon, something they weren't used to. It's also because he underestimated that he had a different view of what the war was all about than what his men did. He was a Macedonian, and today in northern Greece, and the Macedonians thought the purpose of this war was to enrich Macedon. They wanted to conquer, they wanted to get revenge, and they wanted to go home with their loot. That's not what Alexander saw it as. He saw it as creating a new empire of which he would be the king. He was going to create this new, become the king of Asia, replace the Persian king in a new world, a new kind of empire. Macedon was just incidental to it. And he'd gone beyond his men, and he'd lost touch with his men and was no longer able to see what they wanted. And they just weren't willing to buy it. So in the end, they were able to force him to turn home, turn around.
Okay. Well, Caesar was assassinated, at least in part, by three of his own commanders from the Gallic
Wars. That's right.
Alexander died sort of mysteriously, not unlike his dad,
right.
Not long after turning around. Hannibal, again, great leader, but you have a saying from one of your books on your website: a great leader knows not only how to win a battle, but how to use a victory.
Right.
Is this a shortcoming with all of these guys?
Yes, it is a shortcoming with all of these guys. I mean, they're all huge egotists. I mean, they're brilliant, talented people. I mean, they're rare, very rare in history, but they're also enormous egotists, and they don't see their own limits. Alexander, in particular, the fact that he sees his life's purpose as war without end. He's thwarted in India, but then he's about to invade Arabia when he dies. He's probably just dies of a virus, although there's some have a reason to think he was poisoned. And after invading India, he made it clear that next stop was Carthage, and after Carthage was going to come Rome. This is much more than his people ever signed up for. Hannibal was so taken by his ability to win battles that he really did not give enough thought to the strategy of how he was going to win the war. And Caesar, Caesar really had not thought through how he was going to ever get the Roman ruling class on board, what he was going to do with this victory in the Civil War, and just what he could and couldn't do. Now, in fairness to Caesar, he was in a very difficult situation and up against a ruling class that just was not willing to accept change. But he certainly did not handle them as well as he might have. He was quite arrogant about it.
Well, he created the situation too, so.
He did and he didn't. You know, he created it in fighting a civil war.
Mm-hmm.
But by the same token, he had a right to think he deserved a reward for the Republic for what he had achieved in Gaul, in conquering Gaul, and also he was a visionary who understood that the Republic could not go on the way it had been, could not continue down the road it had been on. The Romans could not rule 50 million people with the institutions that they had ruled the city-state. They simply had to come up with a mechanism to absorb and co-opt the ruling elites of the empire and share power with them. They could not go on indefinitely running the empire with just a few families.
Well, the ultimate irony there is someone that you mentioned earlier, Octavian, later known as Augustus, was a nipper when Caesar put him in the will. You know, what was he, 19 or something? At the beginning of the wars after Caesar, the internal strife for Rome, and ultimately he thumped Pompey and Mark Antony and became probably Rome's greatest leader.
Yeah. Well, you know, he's one of history's very greatest examples of precocity and precocious maturity. The fact that at his young age he is able to show the amount of cunning and self-control that he does, and just extraordinary political skill, in some way even greater political skill than Caesar's. I mean, that's really amazing. Really impressive.
Unfortunately, we're not going to be able to get to some of my other favorite things that you've written about, Thermopylae, Xerxes, Salamis, but perhaps another time.
Yeah, that would be great.
Barry, thanks so much for joining me today. Greatly appreciate it.
Thank you, Mark. It's my pleasure, and I thank you for the opportunity and terrific questions.
You've been listening to AmTower Off-Center. You can find Barry, by the way, again, barrystrauss.com. I strongly suggest you take a look at some of these books. They're really, really great stuff, and there's lessons for marketing, for business development, for sales in here, and for leadership in here. And keep in mind that Barry does speak on leadership topics. This is not my day job. If you need help developing a go-to-market strategy, particularly via social media, especially LinkedIn, give me a call. Shoot me an email at markamtower@gmail.com. And thank you very much for listening to AmTower Off-Center.
You've been listening to AmTower Off-Center, sponsored by General Dynamics Information Technology. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. AmTower Off-Center, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.